Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, it's been a long, long, long time since Ohio Governor John Kasich was in the good martini. For various reasons, not getting out of the race, constantly thinking of himself as a potential primary challenger to President Trump. He's still thinking about running in 2020, perhaps even more seriously than we thought. But now it looks like it might be as an independent. And you've written about this in today's Morning Jolt. This all stems from a revealing tidbit in Axios today, which says, quote, Ohio Governor John Kasich, Republican, and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, Democrat, the Johns, as insiders are calling them, have been making a flurry of joint appearances to talk about state-driven improvements to health care. But Axios has learned that their duet is part of an alliance that is gaining momentum toward a possible joint independent bid for president in 2020, likely with Kasich at the top of the ticket. They've gotten to know each other well from a variety of conferences. They're cobbling together this governor's coalition to address health care because they don't like the way that the Republicans in Washington have done it. And so it looks like John Weaver, who, of course, only advises Republicans who don't like Republicans who are named John, as you've pointed out, Jim, looks to be in the mix here as well. So you're saying this could actually be a very good thing for Trump and potentially for conservatives.
Yeah, there's this attitude of, oh, well, John Kasich is a Republican. And I can hear people groaning or saying that really requires air quotes at that moment. So obviously he'll take away from Republican votes. You'd have two Republicans running against one Democrat, and Democrats would be much more likely to win in 2020. By the way, we should begin by saying, look, it's August 2017. We don't know what's going to happen between now and 2020. It's conceivable Trump doesn't run. Knocking on wood, hopefully everything turns out fine for him. But, you know, presidents end up not running for re-election due to personal reasons or health reasons or things like that. We don't know if North Korea is going to set off a nuke. We don't know what the state of the economy is going to be. You know, just a ton of variables. But based on what we see now, you would say, all right, so Trump begins with the states that he won and trying to keep all of them. And as long as he doesn't lose enough of them, he's going to have 270 electoral votes. The challenge is for Democrats. They have to win back certainly the Pennsylvanias, the Ohios, the Wisconsins, the Michigans, all that upper Midwest. And then maybe look at places like North Carolina and Florida, ones that Obama had won. And that really they were surprised, not just that they slipped through their fingers, but slipped, you know, by a considerable amount. I'm thinking particularly Ohio and Iowa and places like that. I think if Kasich and Hickenlooper form this, you know, oh, we're not too much of this, we're not too much of that, we're kind of the Goldilocks, sensible moderates campaign, I think that splits the anti-Trump vote. And I think if you're a Democrat, that probably should keep you up at night, because you want to make that choice as binary as possible, and you want the president's core of support to be as small as possible, and you want as much in your pile. Let's say that Kasich and Hickenlooper only carry their home states. Well, you know, Trump wouldn't have Ohio, and that would take down his supply, but he would still be above 270 electoral votes. On the other hand, Kasich winning Ohio takes Ohio out of the Democrat pile, which means Democrats need another spot to make up those their deficit and reach 270 electoral votes. And if Hickenlooper manages to carry it for an Colorado, well, there's 9 electoral votes that would not be in a Democratic pile. Look, we don't know exactly how they would. We'd be interested to see some polling numbers, but the important thing is in a two-person race, you got to win, you know, 50% and plus one. If you have the marginal small parties like the Libertarians, the Greens, eating a percentage point here, 2 percentage point, it's worth noting in 2016, they actually, a bunch of states, they were in that 5-6% range. So if you're Trump, it's a lot easier to win a plurality than a majority. It's much easier to keep your core of support, which is what he's doing in the polls right now, and throw in the advantages of incumbency, campaigning in the Rose Garden, et cetera, et cetera. All you need is to be in the high 30s or low 40s. And you can, you know, if it splits the right way, you can win with that. So if I'm the Democrats, man, I don't want John Kasich running as an independent. I don't want John Hickenlooper helping him. I want a Republican versus a Democrat and people to be as dissatisfied with Donald Trump as possible. The more you split that pie, the more likely it is that Trump ends up with the biggest slice.
Jim, let me push back on a couple things and at least get your response to this, because there's a couple thoughts that rattled around in my head on this today, especially after reading your take in the Morning Jolt. It would seem to me, based on more recent political trends, that perhaps it's less and less important who the running mate is. So if, in fact, it's Kasich on top of the ticket as opposed to Hickenlooper, that might not be as big of a draw for Democrats, especially when they have such a stark alternative with whoever their nominee is going to be. I assume it's going to be somebody fairly radical, because, I mean, I think if you ask most people on the street, it would take them a few seconds to remember who Hillary's running mate even was last year. And all the people who were excited about Tim Kaine being the running mate conveniently can fit around the Kaine dining room table. So will that make a big difference if, in fact, it's a nominal Republican on the ticket, if the Democrats at least have somebody on the bottom half of this ticket?
Greg, I'm going to take a big red marker and underline nominal. and just like, I mean, like, okay, yes, you know, if particularly, you know, the John Kasich of the mid 90s, when he was on the House Budget Committee, that was a very conservative guy. But you look at this way, not just as he's governed the state of Ohio. I think it was Grover Norquist who put it to me. Most often you have a Republican governor who's fighting with the state legislature, trying to get tax cuts bigger. In Ohio, he says, is one of the weird states where you have a Republican state legislature that's trying to make tax cuts as big as possible, and Governor Kasich keeps shrinking them, right? So you've got that. You've got his full-throated defense of the Medicaid expansion in that state, and just a general hostility to the Trump administration and congressional Republicans' efforts to repeal and replace so far. Patrick Ruffini suggested he thinks he's totally convinced that if Kasich runs as an independent, he would back single payer. I don't know if that will come to pass, but my guess is that if and when Kasich starts running for president, he's not going to sound like a conservative Republican at all. He's going to sound like exactly the kind of tone and style that got rave reviews from the New York Times editorial board. Exactly what made him Joy Behar's favorite. I guess I'm saying that when you're Joy Behar's favorite Republican, you're not really a Republican anymore. I just have a hard time seeing John Kasich running. There's not any room to. There's not a lot of room to Trump's right to be more Trump than Trump. And so my suspicion is he'll run the John Huntsman playbook, you know, the very familiar one. I'm a totally different, sensible Republican. And when you ask him, how are you conservative? The answers are pretty vague, but he's very clear and loves to articulate what he disagrees with the rest of his party on. So my suspicion is that while technically people might refer to him as Republican turned independent, John Kasich, that there would be really very little that is actually Republican about a John Kasich 2020 bid.
You mentioned the divide that could happen among the Democrats. Axios already has two competing quotes here from unnamed Democrats. The first one, quote, no Dem wants Kasich anywhere near our ticket. Sounds like a no labels fantasy, but moderate Dems would hate it. But a veteran operative emails, quote, our political system is completely broken. Something big and historic needs to happen to break the logjam. I'm a big Dem, but I'm for anything that does away with this hyper-partisanship on both sides that is paralyzing our government. So let the intra-party battle begin, I guess, maybe even on both sides. So let's find a story here in our bad martini, Jim, that all of us can agree on, and that's that communists are horrible, horrible people. This is also mentioned in the Morning Jolt today, but actually it's the Washington Post that's calling out the Obama administration for what is so far a gigantic flop in normalizing relations with the Cubans. President Barack Obama's much-hyped restoration of relations with Cuba was a bet that diplomatic and economic engagement would, over time, accomplish what 50 years of boycott did not, a rebirth of political freedom on the island. So far, the results have been dismal. In the 2 years since the U.S. Embassy in Havana reopened, repression of Cubans, measured in detentions, beatings, and political prisoners, has significantly increased, while the private sector has remained stagnant. U.S. exports to Cuba have actually decreased, even as the cash-starved regime of Raul Castro pockets millions of dollars paid by Americans in visa fees and charges at state-run hotels. Now there's another sinister cost to tally, the serious injuries inflicted on the U.S. diplomats dispatched to Havana. News organizations have since provided shocking details. At least 16 American diplomats and family members received medical treatment resulting from sonic attacks directed at the residences where they were required to live by the Cuban government. A number of Canadian diplomats were also affected. CBS News reported that a doctor who evaluated the American and Canadian victims found conditions including mild traumatic brain injury, quote, with likely damage to the central nervous system. So, Jim, the darkest tactics out of the KGB playbook are alive and well here in 2017. They're being targeted against the very country that played nice with them, with asking for almost nothing in return. So basically, when you get into bed with the commies, you're going to get stung.
You know, Greg, I'm going to take everything you said there. I'll take it backwards. First, in the phrase mild traumatic brain injury, I feel like one of those words doesn't belong there. I think once we're talking traumatic brain injury, it feels pretty serious to me. I hope these people make a full recovery. But I don't – if somebody's using a sonic wave to attack your head, I'm just not sure how mild that can be. Beyond that, I was thinking as we were prepping for this podcast, I was thinking about all the times we've heard variations of, if we just are nicer to these people, they will be nicer to us. I'm thinking back – we could take maybe all the way back to most favored nation status for China, certainly the effort to give the Olympics to China and to in Beijing, and then to Russia, the idea that, no, if we, you know, once we put this, once they're in the spotlight, these countries won't possibly be able to misbehave and they'll be on their best behavior. And of course, you know, not only do human rights situations do not improve, you know, Russia got the Winter Olympics in Sochi and then turned around and invaded Georgia. I mean, they did, you know, that did not change their behavior one iota. We see this and, you know, oh, if we just, you know, we're going to negotiate with the Taliban. Smart people like David Petraeus said, no, I really believe if we negotiate with the Taliban, we could get somewhere. It was that guy, Mitt Romney, who's only had the burden of being right about everything ever since then, was one of those guys who said, I don't think negotiations with the Taliban are going to work. Lo and behold, they give it their best effort. Lo and behold, I know it's going to shock you, Greg, but it turns out the Taliban are a bunch of bad guys.
No.
And you can't trust them. And lo and behold, they were not interested in reaching any serious peace or anything like that. Now, apparently, the Trump administration has said they're open to it if our allies want to give it another shot. But in the end, no, he's not, you know, putting a lot of eggs in that basket. Why would we think Cuba, the character of Cuba's regime would change? Why do we think the Castro regime would alter the way it behaves? If anything, this is an escalation, right? We have reached out our hand and they have slapped us in the face or arguably punched us in the face. Yes, of course, these sorts of things directed at U.S. diplomats are not totally unheard of, but it's more almost teenage prankish, like glue in the locks and you know, the occasional slash tire and stuff like that. Our diplomatic personnel overseas live with a certain level of risk, not just the idea of some, you know, someday some Al-Qaeda or ISIS type trying to blow up the building they work in, but just low-level harassment by the local counterintelligence agencies and groups like that. Going through your stuff when you're out, things like that. This is kind of the way the game is played, so to speak. But this is a big dramatic escalation on the part of Cuba, and I'd like to see this administration, you know, offer some sort of serious retaliation. This doesn't mean we should shoot sonic weapons at the Cuban diplomats, but I'm okay with expelling some of these people. I'm okay with various other ways that we can rattle our sabers, so to speak, and demonstrate that if you attack Americans, there will be a proportional response, or maybe even a non-proportional response. This is why you shouldn't attack Americans. But anyway, we will see. It sounds like so far the response from Tillerson's State Department has been less than thrilling and eye-catching, but there's still time. We'll see how this shakes out. But people should stop waiting for the Cuban regime to suddenly become nice guys, because it's just not in the nature of a regime like that.
They were thugs 60 years ago. They're still thugs today. It's that simple. All right, let's move on to our crazy martini now, and let's go back to the United States and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi. Of course, she's been in Congress for 30 years now. She's hoping to become Speaker again after the midterms. Let's hope that doesn't happen. She is concerned right now about a public gathering, I believe, here coming up pretty quickly, called Patriot Prayer, that is going to happen in a public park in San Francisco, and she doesn't think they should be allowed to do that. That, of course, would go against the First Amendment and free speech, and she was called on that by a reporter from a local San Francisco television station, and here's how that exchange went.
How could the Park Service justify denying that organization their free speech rights?
Because the Constitution does not say that a person can shout, yell wolf in a crowded theater. If you are endangering people, then you don't have a constitutional right to do that.
Oh, man, she's sharp. Wolf in a crowded theater, Jim, not fire, which is always the left's example of why free speech should be suppressed. They've already disarmed these people. They're not allowed to bring guns. And now tiki torches are banned because it's tiki torches that lead to riots, not other things. And the organizers of this, most of whom are not white, by the way, are putting out there that Nancy Pelosi is actually making it more risky for them because she's lumping them in with white supremacists when they claim that they are clearly not. And that's likely to draw some disgusting elements to this more likely than they would have otherwise. So what do you make of Nancy Pelosi's difficulties with the English language, which, of course, is nothing new, and the impact she's having on the free speech debate?
Greg, let's take a moment to step into Nancy Pelosi's world, just for a little while, just to see the sudden surprises and incongruencies that can occur. You're going to the theater, you see the famous CNN anchor named Blitzer, and you want to say hello to him. Hey, what? No, you can't do that. The Constitution will not allow you to shout wolf in a crowded theater. Bad news for Duran Duran fans. Mouth is alive with juices like wine, and I'm hungry like the reap. Can't say it. Can't say wolf. Constitution bans it. Nancy Pelosi's world. So the first thing is she clearly meant fire. The legal regime she's pointing to has been pecked to death because people have pointed out. First of all, we should take one more step back further. If the theater you're in is on fire, shout fire. Right? No one has any objection to shouting fire in a crowded theater because as bad as the risk of panic and stampede is, the risk of fire is worse. So if you happen to see it, don't just gently clear your throat until someone notices. Smoke. We should all leave. The legal argument there is that, well, if you shout fire at a crowded theater, you're creating an immediate physical threat to other people. You are immediately endangering other people. And that is something that subsequent Supreme Court decisions have said, look, you got to have that ironclad absolute. Even incitement of an angry crowd is really tough to prove. It's got to be very explicit. Go beat this person. It can't simply say, I hate this person, and someone later on goes to attack them or something like that. Beyond that, I think what Pelosi is inadvertently illustrating here is this concern of when people say, is it okay to punch a Nazi? We had this dispute with that guy who got punched during the Spencer, who got punched during the inauguration. Look, we all hate Nazis. We all can't stand them. They're terrible. We emulate Indiana Jones. We applaud Captain America every time he punches Nazis, right? But once you institute the mentality of, well, some viewpoints are so terrible, some ideas are so abhorrent, some people are so repellent that unprovoked physical assault upon them is justified, well, it really gets dependent on how we define Nazis now, isn't it? If you decide that guy's a Nazi, considering how often people get called Nazis in ordinary politics, and, you know, you think of Godwin's law, the argument that the longer an online argument goes on, the more likely it is that somebody will end up calling the other person a Nazi or comparing them to Adolf Hitler. This is a very subjective measuring stick of that person is a Nazi. I mean, you know, if they're walking around waving a Nazi flag or goose-stepping or Sieg Heiling, okay, that's pretty easy. But the problem is we know deep down people aren't going to be satisfied with that. They're going to want to say, no, that guy's a metaphorical Nazi, and that's why it was okay to punch him. We're having this argument about the statue of the Confederacy, and all of a sudden, Chris Columbus can't have statues anymore. All of a sudden, they're making that effort up in New York, and somebody hit them in Baltimore. We saw the dispute about somebody saying tear it down, spray painting tear it down on a statue of Joan of Arc in New Orleans. Joan of Arc has nothing to do with the Confederacy. She lived many years before then. This idea of the power to violently tear things down, the power to assault someone, and the power to ban speech are all sorts of powers we really don't want to have. We want to constrain those powers of government because those are very dangerous powers in the wrong hands. Nancy Pelosi's decided that does she know that this rally is definitely going to lead to violence? The organizers say they aren't. They've banned the tiki torches. They've banned guns. It seems like they seem to be doing what they want. They want to speak their mind, even if it may be controversial. But they don't want to start any trouble. You're in America. You're free to do that. It's not supposed to pass the "Does Nancy Pelosi like it?" test. And because she doesn't really have a good constitutional reason, she's basically asserting that, well, they're so inherently controversial that they themselves are provocative and they have to be stopped. And she's echoing a lot of Democrats, including Howard Dean on this. Chris Cuomo went down this path. It's, you know, people really want to say, look, I really don't like that speech, so you shouldn't be allowed to do it, which is a fundamentally un-American attitude for our elected leaders to have.
It was Dr. Henry Jones in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade who talked about the goose-stepping morons who should be reading books rather than burning them. So I think
that's right. Maybe they're not the only ones who should be reading books in the Constitution.
Oh, Jim, quite a week it has been. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and have a great weekend. And join us on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.